This is Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. What does America owe to the descendants of Africans who were brought here as slaves? What does it owe to people who are the descendants of African Americans who suffered under Jim Crow and other violent forms of segregation? This is a question that we are starting to face here in America in a really serious way. The idea of reparations, repayment for those wrongs, has really taken hold of the national narrative, and there are several cities that are thinking about ways to get that done. Detroit is one of them. Citizens in the city voted a few years ago to explore the questions around reparations. What happened here to African Americans, and how do we repay those who were harmed? There's now a reparations task force in the city of Detroit that is exploring those issues, and later in 2024, we are likely to get the first report about what they found and what they might recommend. But there are some real questions that swirl around this idea of reparations. Who gets compensated? In what way? And who is responsible for the wrongs that were exacted against African Americans? Also, if we do reach a point where we are trying to repair those harms, what happens afterward? What does America look like? What does America look like after we've tried to fix what went so wrong originally with regard to race and racism in our society? Justin Hansford and Linda Mann are two people who've thought an awful lot about these questions. Linda is executive director at the John Mitchell Justice Project at George Mason Carter School for Peace. She's also an associate professor and research scholar at Columbia University. Justin Hansford is a member of the African American Redress Network Steering Committee. He's the executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center. The Redress Network is actually working with the task force in the city of Detroit, trying to help them find their way through the difficult tasks of cataloging the things that were done to African Americans here and figuring out how to repay. We want to get them today to think about, with us, all of these difficult questions around reparations. How do we decide what that should look like? Who are the people who are owed? And what happens afterward? I'm here with Created Equal's producer, Carrie Jr. II. Carrie, I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
I am too. You laid it out pretty well. I don't know if there's much more I can add to that. I was thinking the same thing. I was like, yeah, that's what I was going to say too. Absolutely.
You know, these are really difficult questions because they get to the essence of who we are, who we are as Americans, all of us, but also who we are as African Americans and who are white Americans. What do we owe each other? What's the relationship today in 2024 between those two communities, given all the things that have happened in the past? And how might that relationship change if we actually address those things?
I love the idea that there are organizations working to address these things, but there's a part of me that feels like there's an enormous hurdles that they have to overcome in order to get real change done, to really right those wrongs. And like you said, like if they do right those wrongs, what happens on the other side of that, right? Do we just go back to being hunky-dory? Do we forget? Not forget, but do we minimize that history? We don't know, but I'll be interested to hear what the guests have to say today.
Yeah. One of the key questions I really want to get to here is the idea of compensation. What does it actually mean?
Right.
I think for a lot of people, that just means money. write me a check
yeah.
for the things that you took from me or the things in my life that you damaged. But one of the things that I know the Redress Network is really working with cities around the country on is thinking more broadly
yeah.
about the other ways that we might make up for the things that were done. Compensation means something much bigger than money. And I really am looking forward to hearing them talk about how we decide what that looks like.
Yeah, they have a lot of different classifications. I don't know that I am on board with other forms yet. I have to hear what they have to say to see if I think that those are
looking for
good
a
enough. Yeah, I mean, hey, it'd always be nice to get back on some of the wealth that we were lost, the land that we were lost. But, you know, understanding more about what the other types of categories they have will be interesting to find out what that might do. I think there might be some things to be gained outside of just financial gain. So.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to it. Linda Mann and Justin Hansford, welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you.
All right. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So I want to start with the Redress Network, the African American Redress Network. I think for listeners, we need to explain what that is and how that work brings you into the conversation about reparations that are taking place all across the country. Justin, I'll start with you.
Yes. Well, first of all, glad to be here. We have been working together, myself and Linda, for almost 4 years now. She does a better job of explaining the ins and outs of the African American Redress Network. But I can give you some broad strokes that say collaboration between initially the Howard University Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center, where I'm the executive director, and the Columbia University Human Rights Institute, where Linda and Elizar Barkan have been working on reparations projects for many years. And what we do is we provide some type of community support, research, advocacy support, sometimes legal support, any sort of support that we can think of for grassroots reparations campaigns all across the nation. Our work has taken us into a number of really amazing, inspiring communities over the past few years. And we've had a number of big victories that I'm sure Linda can talk about in more depth. But of course, one of the more well-known ones was our collaboration with the city of Evanston, Illinois, in 2020, where we helped to defend legally and also do historical research to help make the case for reparations in the city where people consider the first real modern reparations ordinance passed by a city council designed to provide redress for housing discrimination and redlining across that region. And it's been wildly successful, and it's provided a blueprint for local reparations campaigns all across the nation. And we've seen that number just continue to grow and multiply over the past few years. So we're really excited to be here in this moment working on this important issue.
Yeah. Now, Linda, go ahead and expand on what Justin's talking about there in terms of the Redress Network and examples like Evanston.
Sure. As Justin stated, we're collaboration between the two universities. The human rights concentration is at Columbia is actually housed in the School of International and Public Affairs. And I like to say we're use an acronym, RAP, RAP, research, advocacy, and policy. So we kind of fill the gap between research and policy and have been working alongside communities that are advancing racial justice initiatives at the local, at the very micro local level, as well as at the city and state level.
And that work, the focus on community in that work, Linda, talk about why that's important and how that plays out in different communities.
Yeah, that's a great question, because it's really the cornerstone, I think, of the work that we do. We very much walk alongside communities, and we have a very different view of how we collaborate with communities versus, let's say, the traditional research institution. We actually do not go into communities to perform research. We let communities know that we're available, and then we see if we are invited to walk alongside them. We really take lead from the communities. The communities are the ones who are putting forward oftentimes proposals for racial justice initiatives. And so we basically enter into the communities once invited. We do a tremendous amount of listening and collaboration alongside community organizations, as I said, that are advancing the work. In communities, we often actually provide funding to a community liaison, someone who leads that collaboration between our research and developing a final research project, because we value community knowledge. We believe that community leaders have the real pulse on their own history and their experiences of harm. So we look at them as knowledge producers, equal and equivalent to any of our researchers at the university, and we co-collaborate in all of those processes.
And this is difficult stuff. I mean, this very idea of, first of all, facing the history of discrimination that exists in most communities in this country, and then trying to figure a way to repair that discrimination or that inequality. And I think it's really interesting that you guys use the word redress, right? I mean, usually when we're talking about this subject, the word that gets used most often is reparations. Justin, talk about that word redress and the difficulty, I guess, that surrounds the work that these communities are trying to get to redress these harms.
Yeah, well, the word itself, the word reparations itself, is one that is so emotionally charged. And there are a number of people who turn off as soon as you say that word, mm-hmm. and just stop listening.
Yeah.
But there's so much that we need to do as part of the process of healing in this country. You know, some of the work I do also involves the United Nations, which has a five-part framework, which they use for repair and reparation. And that includes everything from apologies for past harms, guarantees of non-repetition, also the idea of providing rehabilitation for those harmed, of course, compensation. There's so much. You know that the National African American Reparations Commission, which I also work with, has talked about the importance of these healing processes being led by those who were directly impacted and harmed, as opposed to just being imposed on them by people in power. So it's such a complex, sophisticated, and rich process. And it is true, sometimes when you use the term reparations, people just start looking in the mail saying, where's my check? And they start thinking about things from a purely financial lens, which is not something that is what we need in our community. We need more than that. I'm not saying that we don't need financial restitution and compensation for harm so that our communities can begin the process of healing. You know, I had a chance to live in Detroit a few years back. I worked for Judge Damon Keith, mm-hmm. As a law clerk there. early 2010, 2011. But I can tell you from my experience, and I have family who live in Detroit, so I can tell you the things that Detroit needs, has needed in the Black community for decades, include housing, include healthcare, include access to education. And these things can't be done without financial support. And the city of Detroit in particular, we know how our, you know, we had that Judge Keith worked on this case in Hamtramck, which was, case study in how the Black bottom in Detroit was systematically destroyed. So, you know, we know about, in particular, in the city of Detroit and the region, how the scourge of racism continued to create disinvestment in Black communities, not just during enslavement, but for basically every decade since. And so we have to heal that to move forward. And we have to have a process that is complex and multifaceted, and that involves everybody coming to the table and providing redress for these harms. So, and that's a long way of answering your question. Reparations is in there. This is about reparations. But we do want people to understand that this is about much more than a check.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's a really great way to put that. Okay, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation on Created Equal with Linda Mann and Justin Hansford. Stay where you are. We'll be right back in a minute.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Created Equal. From 101.9 WDET in Detroit, I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. We're talking today about reparations, something that we are endeavoring here in our community in Detroit to finally reckon with, to think about, and to work through as a task force that's been formed by our city council. Tries to determine the ways that African Americans were harmed in our community over many, many years, and to come up with solutions to those harms. How do we make people whole who were damaged by years, decades, centuries, really, of racial discrimination? We've got two great guests here talking with us about reparations and redress in a broader context. Linda Mann is executive director at the John Mitchell Justice Project at George Mason Carter School for Peace. She's also an associate professor and research scholar at Columbia University and a member of the African American Redress Network Steering Committee. Also with us is Justin Hansford. He is a member of the African American Redress Network Steering Committee and the executive director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center. Also a member of the United Nations Permanent Forum on People of African Descent. He teaches law at Howard University. I want to start this segment with an idea that has been churning around in my head for a while now that we've been talking about reparations, not just here in Detroit, but throughout the nation. I think for a lot of people, it's very hard to come up with a way to think about this in practical or calculable terms, right? And here I'm talking largely about white Americans. I think there are some really simple concepts in our society about harm that one person or one group of people does to another, and the way in which we try to adjudicate those harms. I mean, our court system, our civil court system, really is convened around the idea of determining those things in real specificity. And I guess one of the things I wonder about our conversation about reparations is why we haven't started with those issues. Because I think in some ways it might make it easier for people to grasp the concept here. And so I'm going to throw out a couple of examples. The GI Bill here in America, which was started after World War II and ran up through the years during the Korean War, is a really great example of the way in which policy, federal government policy and state government policy, combined to deny African Americans the same things that were available to whites. Veterans who came home from those wars were eligible under the GI Bill for assistance to get college degrees. They had their tuition paid. They were also eligible for assistance buying homes in various communities. But if you were black and lived, for instance, in Mississippi, and this is a specific example, my father lived in Mississippi, was born there and served in the Korean War. He comes home and can't access the tuition assistance through the GI Bill because he can't be admitted to the universities in Mississippi that are accepting GI Bill money, or that the federal government says it will pay for tuition at, because he's African American. African Americans aren't allowed to do that. The neighborhoods where he might buy a home are not covered by this federal policy, and so you end up with him not getting the same thing that lots of other people were able to get because of the color of his skin. It seems to me that we can put a number on that. We could come up with a value that he was deprived of because of that discrimination. And I think most people would understand that. I think even people who are inclined not to think much of racism would be able to say, oh, I get that. That was taken from you, and that was wrong, and we should pay you. Why hasn't the conversation started there? And am I right that this would be an easier way, I guess, to sell the entire concept of reparation and redress? Linda Mann, what do you think of that?
It's really interesting that you bring up benefits for Black veterans, because we actually worked alongside an organization that was focused on justice for Black veterans. And I can appreciate you bringing up the GI Bill. There's no question that the GI Bill, although it was designed to provide compensation for loan programs for higher ed and housing benefits, that individuals who were African American or of African descent were denied. And I can tell you that the Justice for Black Veterans was trying to put forward a bill just basically as you are suggesting, and hit a stone wall in DC. And
describe what that stone wall was. What stopped them?
I mean, there was some support, but they didn't have enough support. And there was a sense that there are things that are happening within the Veterans Association that are responding to this already, and they have some policies that are put in place, and that providing a direct compensation was not going to be the specific answer to what you're discussing. And I do believe that there were some attempts by the Veterans Association to respond to some of these. And I think there's still some action in regards to the concerns that you're raising. But again, I think there is this, as you were talking with Justin, this complete desire to put your hand up in regards to reparations. Like, no, we're not going to do a compensatory reparations. We'll create policies that will focus, let's say, on DEI, right, on diversity, equity, and inclusion. as a response. And the actual concept of giving compensatory reparations directly is something that has kept the country somewhat frozen on talking about compensation. That said, you know, there are policies that have been implemented that have compensatory pieces to it, but they often tend to come in a different form. So, you know, Evanston is an example of housing.
Right.
There have also been examples in the United States on scholarship funds, on money going directly to education to compensate for, let's say, in the GI Bill, the lack of not providing higher education. So in some communities, in some states, there has been the passage of a reparative justice policy that targets specific education deprivation.
Yeah. I guess what I'm getting at in some ways is the narrative framework here, right? And I guess an idea in my mind that the narrative framework is easier to grasp maybe if it looks like other things that we do in our society. If it looked, for instance, like the civil tort system, right? You did this to me. It caused this damage, and you owe me this money as a result. Justin, for instance, another example: land that was taken from African Americans in cities all across America because they were African American, right? You don't own this anymore. We're taking it and giving it to someone else. That's calculable. That's similar to other things that white Americans, other Americans might experience in their own lives. Why not sell it that way? Or why doesn't it sell that way? Justin, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there are a number of ways to oppose this. And our politics is so fractured, especially when it comes to things like race. You know, it's hard to really understand the extent to which people who may think in clear terms of justice and doing what's right when it comes to many other topics, when the race comes up, you know, we have a presidential candidate who just finished saying that, you know, there's no racism in this country, or America isn't a racist country,
and
or something.
Never was,
and
right.
And never was. and got a lot of cheers and claps for that. So it's not, I mean, we could go through the things that are said in terms of the narratives that, oh, this is reverse racism. We've already come so far. You know, it's these things happened too long ago. It'll be too complicated to provide repair. This will open the floodgates to many other types of claims. But the reality is, societies around the world have and are and will continue to provide collective justice for harms that are done. I mean, we know about, of course, the situation in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And, mm-hmm. you know, we know about even, you know, in Germany after the Holocaust, you know, millions and millions of dollars of reparations given there. I mean, there's even in here in the United States, there were reparations given for those victims of Japanese internment.
Yes.
So at the end of the day, it comes down to people coming to the conclusion that it's time to make our society more whole. And you can't do that. You can't move forward without healing these wounds. It's not, and I do want to say that it's not a situation where this is a hopeless cause. I do want to say that I think it's Pew Research Center about 10 years ago said that there were maybe 15% of Americans who supported reparations, and now that's up to 30%.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the Reparations Commission that was launched, of course, in state of California, the one in New York that just was launched in December. Our students at Howard counted over 40 cities that have launched reparations commissions in the past few years. You know, Linda and I were at a convening in Evanston in December with over 270 advocates from 28 different states who are working on reparations. That doesn't count the universities like Harvard University and Georgetown University that have initiated reparations processes. So one message I want to make sure that people understand is that this is not a project that is as pie in the sky or hopeless that it might even 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
It's more within our reach.
More within our reach. And I know there are some great reparations advocates coming out of Detroit. Reverend Joanne Watson, who passed away recently. John Conyers himself, the one who introduced H.R. 40
every year.
Every year. So Detroit is really a city that for decades, generations, has been at the center of this movement. And, Representative Conyers, Reverend Watson, they probably could never have dreamed that in 2024, we'd have as much progress as we do on the state level, on the city level, on the university level, churches, and eventually we're going to get that H.R. 40 passed. So I want people to know that this is a movement that has accomplished more than anyone in recent history could probably ever dream that it would. And we're at a great moment for this to actually become a reality.
That's a really great, that's a really great optimistic outlook. And it's really interesting to hear you put it in that context to say, look, maybe we're not there yet where we need to be in terms of consciousness and acceptance of this, but we've moved quite a bit, in that direction, and that we are maybe on the verge of a wider acceptance and an actual effort to do this on a large scale. Okay, we need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue on Created Equal with Linda Mann and Justin Hansford. Listening to Created Equal on 101.9 WDET, Detroit's public radio station. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad that you have decided to join us. We're talking with Linda Mann and Justin Hansford. They are both members of the steering committee of the African American Redress Network. We're talking about reparations, something we have been talking about here in Detroit for some time, a subject that is actually seeing some action here in Detroit. There's a task force that was created by the Detroit City Council to look into the harms that were done historically to African Americans in our community and to think about ways to repair the damage that was done. Linda and Justin, I want to start this time with a different idea, and it's taking us into the future, I guess. Let's say we get to the point where a large-scale effort at reparations or redress is undertaken in our country, and we're living in a society where that has been done. I once had a conversation with Ta-Nehisi Coates after his epic piece in The Atlantic about reparations, about this, and I asked him whether he feared, like I do sometimes, that if this happened, we would move to a space where people might believe that there isn't more work to be done, that the obligation to African Americans would be fulfilled, and that there wouldn't be more to have to think about, more to have to do to make up for what is now several centuries of inequality, of discrimination. And so I would love to have both of you talk just a little about what you imagine that world would look like and whether we would have a real problem, a new problem that would deny the inevitable, I think, lingering effect of systemic inequality, even in a world where reparations or redress was undertaken and in a serious way. Justin, is that a realistic fear?
That is. I'm glad you raised that issue. It's not a valid fear to me. Number one, of course, we live in a world right now where plenty of people are resisting doing any sort of reparative work. So it's not as if once reparations happens, it'll be a new day where suddenly people will stop wanting to help Black people. That's how we.
They don't want to do it now, right?
You know, but it is a good point that perhaps what you're saying is that then in this imaginary future, even the progressive communities who are willing to help will feel like, okay, we've crossed this hurdle and now we can move on to the next problem. The issue here is, I believe that what we're ultimately aiming for is a just, equitable society, and the work of creating that justice is never going to stop. Even if it's, you know, even if hypothetically we get to a stage where we say, okay, we have made a major step in redressing past harms, you still have to create equity. You still have to have access to clean water and access to education and access to housing. And these are projects that are going to take generations for us to get to a place where we are on a equal playing field across society. So it's not a project. Even if you have an infusion of funds that happened over the course of 5 or 10 years, you're not going to be able to completely transform American institutions in a decade or so and say, now we can move on. Everything is equitable. That project of creating a fair and just society is a never ending project. So to me, I understand where people are, going with that. You know, it is this idea that, you know, we have a claim right now, and if we promote our claim and our claim is redressed, then we won't have any sort of claims anymore. And where will we be then? But it's always going to be up to us to create the best lives for our communities, for our people, for our children, as we possibly can. That's never going to change. That's how it is now. That's how it's going to be in the future. And, you know, it's one of those imaginary fears, you know, that is sort of like this fear of too much progress.
Right.
You could say that for anything you do. You say, why would we end mass incarceration? Because then all these people would have to find jobs or something. No, we want to end mass incarceration now, and then we'll deal with those other problems.
We'll deal with the problems when they come, right?
When they come, right? Yep. So,
yeah.
You know, it's a good discussion, but I do want to make sure that, you know, we stay in a place of hope and a place of change. And it's never going to be a situation where someone's going to say, okay, well, we don't have to work for justice anymore because we made this one leap forward.
Yeah.
Society's always going to have to work for justice.
Yeah, and I think the difficulty is in making that point because, you know, even if you support the idea of reparations in this on a large scale, I think there's some education we still need to do about the fact that that won't fix everything. It can't fix everything. I mean, we're talking about centuries and an entire society, an entire nation that was built on these ideas of inequality. And no matter what we do from a reparative standpoint, we can't erase what is already there. And I think it would be crazy to think that repair could make it possible for us never to have to think or talk about this again, Linda.
Yeah, and I just want to add to this conversation a couple of points. First of all, you know, the United States is not alone in this conversation. There, countries across the world are working to respond to colonialism and the impacts of colonialism, which was centuries. So you're not going to undo centuries of harm in which, you know, nations, you know, dislocated people from land, mm-hmm. Oppressed people culturally, changed economic structures, even denied the existence of communities, right? And so this is a worldwide conversation as well. And justice in that, you know, and that is the importance also, I want to raise this up, of Justin's work at the United Nations, because raising this up to the international arena is incredibly important, because the United States is often looked upon as an island unto itself. Like, we don't have these issues. Mm-hmm. We are exempt of that. That is an incorrect, that's a fallacy. But because these are centuries in the making, you know, this is going to take an incredibly long time to undo the systematic aspects of it that exist in all of the institutions and organizations that are often advancing this work. Just the way that institutions are developed in the way that they do or do not, let's say, engage with communities would be a perfect example. But when you look at repair initiatives in any space, whether it's international or within the United States, it's a process. There's a site in Virginia where they passed reparative, compensatory reparations for, and I kind of alluded this to before, for education that was denied during massive resistance, which mm-hmm. was a period after Brown v. Board.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically the majority of the Confederate states enacted this resistance to desegregating schools. Anyway, the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, passed a reparations scholarship program. That was the first piece.
Mm-hmm.
Then over time, they began to do memorialization. Now we're seeing integration into curriculum, required education in the curriculum on this history, so it's not erased. Now we're seeing the compensation scholarship going to the next generation, because the impact was generational, because the literacy rates for that cohort of who were denied education was 75%. So you're beginning to see this, you know, justice is, I want to say, it's ongoing.
Yeah, it's iterative, right?
It's a process, and it's not a one and done. You can't enact a policy and say, we did it, it's great, we're over with. No, it's a process, and it's almost like an unpeeling of an onion, and there are layers, and as you peel back one layer, you see another. And hopefully, if we're committed, we'll continue to peel back those layers so that, as Justin was saying, we have a more just society that really does care for all members.
Yeah, yeah. I want to end our conversation back here in Detroit, where I know you guys are just kind of beginning, really, some of the work that you'll do with our reparations task force and our city council. And I want to get your early impressions of where we are, what we're doing here, and what it says, not just about us, but about this issue nationally. One of the things that we talk about a lot here in Detroit is how symbolic Detroit and its history are to the struggles that we have nationally as Americans, particularly when you're talking about race and inequality. And I just wonder if you're at a point yet where you're seeing some of that play out or influence the dynamic in terms of what we're trying to do here. And of course, we're very early in it, and we don't even have a report yet about the history. But I know that you're working with our task force, and I'm curious about your reaction so far. Linda, I'll start with you this time.
Well, first of all, I just want to give a shout out to the members of the Reparations Task Force that have been assisting us in the process. They've been exceptional. And we have actually been connected to a significant number of organizations that are working specifically on repair initiatives in the communities. And that's a really important piece. So I want to say that, you know, the fact that you have so many organizations that are very well founded in their efforts to address like criminal justice or to address education disparities or food insecurity is a real benefit, actually, because you already have a very strong core of community-led organizations that are already doing this work and know how to do it in their communities. Mm. And that will be an incredible asset to our research because we will learn from them what's worked in the communities and how they've been filling the gap for those services that the government has not provided. So that's an important piece to our process, and I think we're in good shape.
Wow. Yeah. Justin, what are you seeing here in Detroit?
You know, I mean, it's very early to tell with the City of Detroit's commission. And to be honest, the very few commissions around the country have been completed in terms of their work. So this is a really a new day for all of us. But, you know, one of the things that we're hoping to do is to come in, and we have something we call the Black Audit Project, where we try to take a snapshot of the state of the Black community in cities around the country, mm-hmm. using the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals as our measure. So the real questions we want to ask are, how is Detroit doing in terms of access to healthcare, access to education, access to clean water, access to housing, access to, you know, criminal justice equity? How is Black Detroit doing on these measures? And if we do see disparities, and I'm sure we will, mm-hmm. if we do see problems, how much of those problems are due to structural issues that go back generations that demand some sort of restorative redress and repair and reparation? Yeah. And that's what we're hoping to be able to document during our time in Detroit. We can only do that with the community's involvement. And if there are solutions that are going to come from this process, it's going to come from the City of Detroit.
It's going to come from us as Detroiters. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to come from Detroiters themselves. It's going to come from the grassroots. So if I could leave with one message, I would tell everyone to just keep hope alive and come out. And, you know, we're going to do everything we can to make change in the city and cities around the country and around the world where our people are facing injustice. And this is the first step. We have to enter the conversation and be willing to engage. And we start here.
Yeah. Get involved. That's the message here, right? We can all play a part as Detroiters in this process. Okay, Linda Mann and Justin Hansford, both steering committee members of the African American Redress Network. It was really wonderful to have you here for this conversation on Created Equal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode of Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org and make sure you subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. Additional production support comes from Jack Philbrant. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music for Created Equal is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.